Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
Disgusting.
And it starts right now. Oh, what was that?
I just buried a throat clear.
That was amazing.
First joke of the day.
That was like a shotgun blast. It sounded like my dad was here on the podcast for a minute. Bah!
I'm a master at, you know, burying coughs and farts and other sounds. Done it on here.
Such a master.
I wanted to do it. My move, and when I lived in New York and you were with someone,
yes,
used to be, you know, if you're waiting for the subway and the subway comes down, you can just lay a fart right in there. And then the wind of the subway also blows the fart away.
It could be anyone's fart at that point.
I mean, yeah. I don't know how you live in New York and survive without knowing the fact that the subway how you buried your farts.
Yes. You have such plausible deniability.
Yeah. Totally.
I mean, that's why life in LA, it's harder.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
No,
there's
way
no reason to go to the subway in LA.
Yes.
An earthquake, Barry.
That was very well done. It reminds me, Goldie, of a Family Guy cutaway from years ago. Maybe you were there for that, but it was Peter using thunder to cover his farts during a business meeting. And so, you know, there's somebody giving a presentation and you see the lightning flash. And then a few seconds later, there's thunder and you see him lift his leg. It happens again. He lifts his leg. Then the third time, he farts too early and you hear the fart and then you hear the thunder and Peter goes, oh, good. The storm's moving away. And so that always reminded me of that.
Funny.
But very, very well done.
Anything good I wasn't there for.
Not true. Train on a water, boat on a track. One of my favorite songs by Goldie. And also, of course, number one for the 10,000th week in a row.
Hiya, hiya, hiya.
That was when the country was all Native American in one of our theoretical worlds. And it was Goldie as the DJ doing that, which was hilarious. but Goldie, you and I both have some medical reports today. So I want to go down, you know, the last few weeks people are calling me a champion.
Oh,
a champion for for colonoscopy, for health, for anal health.
God.
I wanted to give the final update on this. So the word final should make you happy, but here are three words I had never heard before.
Ooh.
Tubular villus adenoma.
Oh.
Now, I ain't much on adenoma. That was a reference to an 80s song called Casanova. But tubular villus adenoma was the polyp that I had in my ass that was removed by this great doctor, Dr. Karuki. And when I talked to him on the phone and I mentioned that I've been mentioning this on the podcast, he said, you can mention me by name. So Dr. Karukian did an amazing job. And this tubular villus adenoma is the kind of polyp that if left untreated will become cancer.
Oh, wow.
So this guy got this out of there. And it makes perfect sense to me that my asshole is trying to sabotage me from the inside. You know, like after all the shit I've put it through all these years, it makes sense. But Dr. Karukian went in there, got it, I'm considering having it mounted over the fireplace like a moose head, just so we can all enjoy this.
Can you get a slide of it?
Yes.
Ooh.
And look at it under a microscope?
Probably.
That's why my dad used to get me slides, and I would look at stuff under microscopes. Obviously, it did good, because it's not like it turned me into an inquisitive person
or a scientist or
no. But I used to like very seriously get out my microscope and my slides and be like, "I'm going to look at these," and then I would look at them and then I would put them away. But I would do this a lot.
That's incredibly interesting. I remember having to do that in like science class, but I never did it. It was never a home hobby for me. Anyway, so that's the end of the colonoscopy run.
It was
this victory. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I can say honestly this time that people should go get a colonoscopy because this is what happens. God. You know what, folks? People of a certain age. Let me lay it down for you like this.
Do you feel a step lighter now that you
You step quicker? Absolutely. I'm faster to the basket now because
but does this mean you have to maintain, you have to keep getting checked because you
It's self check. It's self checking now. I just take a Q-tip and go to town. So.
Oh my God.
Well, just while we're in this neighborhood,
this Q-tip area,
I never have a day at home that is just unmolested.
Yeah.
So, you know, and COVID basically, and the advent of Zoom has made everything essentially voluntary. That people only, anything can be canceled for any reason.
Yep.
And people may or may not show up. And even our work is on Zoom, you know, a third of the time.
Right.
Right.
And literally everyone has the second screen in front of their main screen, and they think they're getting away with staring at the second screen, and you don't notice. Like, there's some great spy going like, "I'm secretly just Googling stuff I want and online shopping, and this idiot has no idea I'm doing it." It's like, "I'm doing it too."
Yeah.
Okay?
By the way.
Yeah. Yes. And you're bathed in a white light. Like, you can see when someone's looking at something else.
Yeah. So I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
No. That I know you're looking at this. But anyway, so we have a table read today. Our table reads are virtual. And these days it's kind of like, oh, that's a day I can relax. But of course, last night my youngest kid comes up and is like, "I think I have pink eye." Now, the eye is the eye looks like Red Dawn. You have pink eye.
The Khmer Rouge.
Yeah. Like your arm falling off. I think I was hit.
Yeah,
you were hit. So anyway, I'm just home with someone with a wonk eye.
Oh,
from,
my God.
You know, and but she wasn't the origin of it. You know, someone else touched their butt because it's interesting. You can trace it through the school. But I'm dealing with something of my own, bravely.
What is that?
Bravely.
Which I want to talk about.
Okay.
This is serious. For the last 3 days, I have had a blocked ear.
Oh.
This is serious.
Now, when my ear gets blocked,
yep.
I am ready to blow my brains out.
Oh, no.
The second it's blocked, I go, "It's over. This is this is permanent. This is life. I cannot deal with this. I already feel crazy enough with my thoughts, and now I'm literally trapped in my head." I would give any amount of money to get my ear unblocked. I would give you my house.
Wow.
I would commit atrocities against my own family to get my ear unblocked.
Wow. Oh,
so I was bravely dealing with this. I wasn't telling a lot of people. I wasn't going around. You know, I wasn't letting people know how much I was struggling, but I was trapped in my own head.
Yeah.
With this blocked ear. And it's that MacGruber thing where you go, "I will fuck anything in this office."
Yeah.
"I will suck your dick
to get rid of this
ear." But I remained calm.
Yes.
I'm happy to report my ear is unblocked. And I know a lot of people out there, are going to say, "Did you try the Valsalva maneuver?"
What's that?
The Valsalva maneuver is what blocked my ear, okay?
Oh, no.
The Valsalva maneuver is when you grab your nose and pinch it and then blow outwards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Done wrong. It can have the exact opposite effect of what you were seeking.
Yeah.
And trap you in an air bubble of your own demise. So I deserve the blue ribbon which is the, I believe, the blocked ear ribbon that you wear on your
yes, I think you're right on that.
To let other know you are a survivor.
God. Well,
you know, how did it unblock?
Patience. I held a cup with a hot, wet paper towel on the bottom over my ear.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't know if that's medically sanctioned, but I hear it creates a vacuum and then turns the stuff to liquid. And over the course of days, it seemed to work itself out.
Oh, that's amazing. God.
I don't have the guts for the Volsava maneuver.
A world of hell.
I know.
It's an all or nothing gamble. It is pushing your chips in and saying, I'm either going to have an ear blocked worse than it's ever been the rest of my life or be totally free. And we're about to fucking find out.
Yes.
I should have gone live on Instagram when I did the Volsava maneuver because it went drastically wrong, my friend.
Wow. God. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have the guts. I don't have the guts. I feel the pressure building and I just back away and say, this will work itself out. Like, I can't. Yeah. I can't.
I've had one for a month before, which has me a little paranoid.
Yeah, that's like it's like having the hiccups for an extended period of time. You're just like, I want to die. It's time to cull myself from the herd.
Yeah,
it's
completely out of your control.
God, well.
Well, welcome back.
JC, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Sleep? I can't sleep. Oh, I got those
me
gummies.
Either. No sleep last night.
No sleep.
But sweet dreams, Goldie, right? Sweet dreams?
Actually not.
Oh, man. That's
so
good, though.
JC, you're not sleeping?
I'm not sleeping, and when I do, I'm actually having weird anxiety dreams. Like, I had this dream I was supposed to record Seth, but it was for...
Seth?
But it was in...
Seth?
A whole new studio, and he was very patient, and I couldn't figure it out, and I was having all these technical difficulties.
That's how you know it's a dream, that he's very patient.
Well, I was going to say, you know it's a dream because he didn't cancel.
Oh, well, then he came downstairs in this random studio that he had, and he was like, you're not figuring this out. Forget it. I'm bringing somebody else in and brought in like this random friend of mine that it's not even an engineer.
Oh.
And it was just this awful anxiety dream, and I was fired, and it was just a nightmare. Maybe it was actually a dream come true. Like, I'm praying for this dream to come true.
No, you are not.
Maybe it happened.
I know.
You're really tired. Are we sure this wasn't reality?
Is it real? I know.
He's set to record today, so we'll find out.
That's true. It's not. I'm not recording it.
Oh, there you go. Maybe it was real.
I'm fired.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
It's all real.
Something that is unfortunately all too real that we do every week. Let's get in to Johnny Jokes.
Whoa, from Hollywood, Hollywood, here's Johnny's.
Woo!
Oh, boy. I was talking to JC earlier. I have a bunch this week. I'm going to pick the wrong ones, and I'm not sure any of them are good, but let's get started. A pit bull breeder in California has been killed by his own dogs. Yeah. Funeral services will be held as soon as he's carefully plucked out of 38 doo-doos. 38 doo-doos. Let's get down to my old friend scientist.
I thought that was going to go somewhere in the funeral will be held as soon as someone says, drop it.
Drop it. Oh, that's drop better. It. That's better. That's better. I was so enamored with the term 38 doo-doos that I was blind to the other possibilities. But drop it would have been that's a by the way, that's a more Johnny joke too. Because you could never say 38 doo-doos on old Carson. All right, but back to my old friend scientists. Scientists have discovered that the male or Y chromosome is slowly disappearing. Huh. Guess he's married.
Oh my God. Very Johnny.
And more from scientists. They now have discovered that orgasms rewire the brain to create a lasting bond with the partner. This explains why I love my wife and why she wants to shoot me for chewing gum. She gets annoyed at little things. At little things. Because that bond is... She does not have the orgasm. And I do. Love flows from me.
Okay.
An annoyance flows from her. I love... Okay. You know what? I said picking the wrong ones. And here we are doing it.
Love explaining jokes.
Yeah. Here we are doing it. Explaining Johnny's a new segment.
A rare miss.
Oh, that's sweet.
And finally, thank Christ. Finally. A new documentary about the Doors and how they fell apart will be released next month. Producers were working on it until the last minute in order to include interviews from Boeing. Doors falling apart.
Yep.
Just much like this segment. Johnny 2, put it back together.
Boeing gone.
There it is.
Not that I'm set up for some great triumph here, my friend. Well... Bibi Netanyahu is ramping up the Israeli offensive in Gaza. Not a great sign. Right before the latest attack was launched, he yelled, "Leroy Jenkins!"
Love it.
Sort of what it is, isn't it?
Yeah,
it
kind of is.
Right, I got two norms.
Oh,
in the
wow.
Middle. Two norms. Nikki Haley got crushed in her home state of South Carolina, losing the primary to Donald Trump by over 20%.
Wow.
Yeah. Experts say Haley would have stood a better chance with Republican voters if she committed more rapes. Okay. Another norm. Notorious murderer, Joran Vandersloot. Is having conjugal visits with three different women in prison.
Wow.
Wow. And that's on top of all the guys he's fucking.
Norm.
Okay, back to Johnny, which
is thank God.
Hard to do. Well, this is not great news. Mexico City may run out of water in as soon as 4 months.
Ooh.
Yeah, the drought threatens to leave millions of residents with no way to get diarrhea. And finally, Major League Baseball has come out with new uniforms, and players are irate because the pants are transparent.
Ooh.
Fortunately for them, no one watches baseball.
Excellent. Great. Excellent. And we've talked about this before, but there's a hilarious dynamic that happens during Johnny jokes, because when I'm telling my Johnny jokes, you are still very much preparing for yours.
It's the the stand up thing in me. Yeah. So, but go on. Yeah.
And when you do your Johnny jokes, I have this sense of relief. Like, I'm free and easy.
And laughs are much easier for you.
I could never. When I was doing stand-up, I had such paranoia that I would just forget literally everything, that I would over and over just be repeating stuff to myself till I went on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So, it's the same thing. Same thing. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, no, it's okay. You know what? I love your jokes. And I love being in a position where I can actually enjoy the comedy.
I mean, we could flip. I could go first some week.
I'm not delusional. I would not flip, because as I'm on-air talent. But I'm also a producer of this podcast, and I think as a producer, it is my duty to have you close.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know you were a producer.
Yeah, I am. You'll get there one day.
Yeah.
JC and I have a lot of closed door meetings about
it. Oh, yeah.
Right. I don't want to be a producer.
Okay, good.
You're not CJ. An anti-deucer.
You're an amateur deucer, which I prove every morning.
I'm just a deucer.
And thanks to the removal of a tubular villus adenoma, I'm a more comfortable deucer at this point. And
these tubulous Miller adenoma fans are throwing down their clipboards in disappointment.
Headsets are getting tossed onto the ground. All right, that was fun. And yeah, we got our guests coming up.
I'm very excited.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
What a treat to have this guest today. This is someone who I read her book and was so impressed, I finagled a way to contact her out of the blue. Don't try this if you're a fan of the book. It's just something I did. And she agreed to be on the podcast.
Thankfully.
The book is called Bottoms Up and the Devil Laughs. It's just an incredibly written account of how data influences our lives, and we'll get into how deeply this story goes. But please welcome to our podcast New York Magazine writer, author, real writer, Carrie Holly.
Yeah.
Thank welcome. You.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for being
nice
here.
To be here.
So when I read this book, I put it down and I was like, how did she do that? I don't understand how you did it. Like, I just, how did you even get into this story? Was it something you were reporting on and then it became bigger and bigger?
Not really. It was more, I became interested in this question, this kind of unspoken anxiety that I think a lot of people are feeling, especially over like elder millennial Gen X kind of generation, where we're in, like, we've just created a society in which we're watched all the time, in which we know that our identities are kind of alienable from us. Like, our group texts can, you know, suddenly appear in a subpoena, that that there, like, pieces of us exist in the ether that can be said to be us and factually are us, but don't feel that they really represent our identities. Like, that we've just come to this state, and that something massive has changed, but it's very hard to talk directly about it. And every time I would look for a book that was kind of about that anxiety, that book would veer into, like, okay, this is actually about like computer science or the history of surveillance or terrorism in America. You know, like, it was like no one could, like, sit with it. And so I thought I would try to do that. And I think,
was this something you had pitched at, you know, your place of employment and said, hey, I think this is really big? Or was it something you said, this is too big and too good, I don't want to give it to them? Or
no one wants, like, a pink book about surveillance. Like, there was no point pitching the book, you know, like,
right.
So no, it was just kind of something I started from there, from that anxiety. And I had written this other piece about a whistleblower named Reality Winner. I had written that for New York Magazine. Okay. And so I knew that there was this shadow state, which we'd all just kind of collectively decided not to talk about, right? Like, this massive literal infrastructure. It's stuff, right? It's giant building. Yeah. And it's fiber optic cables and it's satellites. Like, all this stuff exists, but it kind of gets siloed into this other thing, the war on terror, instead of this thing that we live with and under.
It's so interesting how the confluence of moving forward in technology, i.e. like smartphones and you know, social platforms and all that, kind of came exactly at this 9/11 moment. And you write a lot about this in the first half of the book, where just the sweeping, unquestioned changes that occurred in our society because of 9/11, because it felt like we were taken advantage of as a collective, because it was like, look over here, we all agree this is bad, and here behind closed doors, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and it's going to take away all your privacy. Do you see it like that? Like, that was the moment where it all kind of, we went zero America?
Yeah, I think that that opened the door, and people were like, whatever you need, right?
Yeah.
And those things were built. But the thing is that those things persist. And so we have an internet which is inseparable from surveillance. Like, to be on the internet is to be surveilled.
Yeah.
And wow. I don't say any of this with this like halcyon, like, oh, things were better before, you know, like,
yeah.
But it's a fact that this change has occurred in our lifetimes, very much because of what you're talking about. And yet we seem to think that that was like a historical fact, like, I don't know, Snowden took care of it or something.
Right.
Well, I do remember you, because I was 10 blocks away on 9/11, and I've shared some memories on here about like different hilarious things. Like, one guy ran out in the street and he was like, yo, they also got the pentagram. And it's like, okay, I know what you're trying to say, but like, that's not. But one thing I remember was going home and turning on the radio that night and listening to talk radio. And there were people calling in and they were like, you know, I'm from South Carolina, and I want to see a flag hanging outside every window in New York City. Where are their flags? And it's like, I remember thinking like, hey, I haven't had time to go to Kmart today. Like, I was fleeing a death cloud. You know, but you talk about that in your book and for Reality Winner, and it seems like for a few of the people in the book, 9/11 was actually the beginning of their patriotism, ironically. And so... When you hear that, like, what do you think was the key thing that where did it go wrong here? Like, was it just the failure of George Bush to harness this goodwill and do something else and to call for restraint? Or was it just people, like you said, wanting to help out and then opening the door, and then that just becomes a business, and now these businesses make money through data, and that's that?
I mean, where it went wrong is a big question. One thing I will say is that I think it's impossible to talk about any of this stuff honestly without a sense of humor. That, like, it was the torture program, for example, hilarious. Was such an absolute, like, amateur shit show. You know, it was just like a guy who had a degree in family therapy, who was just like, let's try some shit. And then he would get upset. And then the CIA would literally be like, this is on the record, call him a pussy. And he would get upset. God.
What you're alluding to is in your book is you said, like, basically no one knew how to torture. Really.
Right.
Crazy.
And yeah. There's a sense, you know, from my perspective, and I'm not funny, but the book is funny. Like,
yes.
There's this sense that I think we've taken on largely from Hollywood, that the way government operates is with this like kind of earnest, like West Wing, like Oppenheimer, self-serious, like can-do spirit. And the way the world operates is a lot more like burn after reading or in the loop, you know, like you have to be attuned to a sense of absurdity to understand how any of this works, which is all to say that like what you were saying about like, I have to go get a flag, like that was real. Like that was very much the response. And like, I don't know if it was about like helping out. It was about like just a lot of emoting, right? Yeah. A lot of like unrestrained emoting, like spend whatever you need. And those structures persist and they're here now. And people like Reality Winner get caught up in them.
So going by the structure of the book a little bit, like one of the first people you bring up the book is this guy, John Walker Lind, who was, you know, known as the American Taliban, who was like a young kid who had gone over to study in, you know, these madrasas to become a better Muslim.
He went to the same high school I went to.
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yes.
Northern California. Yeah.
Tamil Pius High School.
There you go.
What a source of pride for you.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
I have Steve Carell. But John
Sorry
Walker
to interrupt
Lind is
you,
cool,
Goldie.
Too.
So, because you bring up all these things in the book, and I remember them happening in the news. As a person who reads the news, but then forgets about it. Like, I thought John Walker Lind was the guy who was shooting people on the DC Parkway with that older guy. But that was a guy named Lee Boyd Malvo, and that was John Allen Muhammad. So I instantly was like, oh, wait. Okay. So, but reading about him, like, he reminded me of, like, I could think of four kids in my high school who were like this, who were just contrarian. Like, it just seemed, have you met him? Have you talked to him? Or were you just doing reporting and picking up from secondary sources what he
was
like?
I have not met him. I think of him now as, like, the one person in America who actually has privacy because he's, like, totally unreachable. But he, like, I totally agree with you. You know people like this. He's just someone who's, like, I'm 20 and I'm committing to my ideals, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Everyone else is corrupt, but I'm going to be the purest Muslim.
I'm just wondering, in your research of this, was it just because, like, because I could see that all being because he didn't make JV basketball or something. Like, was there a Spider-Man event that was maybe so mundane that we don't think about, like, you know, he was left off the debate team or,
right.
you know,
he was like a sick kid who was home online, basically. Yeah, he was okay. Like a sick, small, beautiful boy.
Right.
And I think it's very much, it was very much like this 20 something who had these ideals, but then America is always going to put itself at the center of the story. So after 9/11 happened, they were like, well, this guy was trying to destroy the United States, but like, there's no evidence that he was very much like had some bad instincts and was very naive, but he wasn't trying to like cause 9/11.
So how did you learn about him? I mean, do you talk to people who knew him? Do you make calls? I'm asking you, I guess, I don't know nothing about journalism. I mean, because I would just go like, I'll go online and I'll Google John Walker Lind. And then according to your book, I'll be in a database and I'll be let out in handcuffs and I'll be tried and they'll find my joke text and they'll read them as serious and that'll be that. But so how do you start doing that to gather information and to paint a picture of this unknowable guy?
I mean, the nice thing about my job is that I can just call up anyone I want. You know, like I have like cover.
Yeah.
In this case, I was not able really to do much original reporting about John Walker Lind. That story has been told and he's not reachable. So a lot of that is like things get reported so badly in the moment.
Yes.
Right. And so a lot of that was just going back and like looking at the testimony and asking what was real and what was just like the cloud of media.
Because when this was about 10 or 12 years ago, someone came to write a New York Times Sunday Magazine story about Family Guy, and they came in the room and they interviewed us. And it was just a little piece and they got literally everything wrong. Like articles like, no, that person wasn't the head writer. No, that isn't how it worked. No, that isn't how. And then that made me go, well, like when they're in Fallujah, like what is happening? Like, it's all wrong. So I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but when you read stuff, are you just thinking to yourself, well, this is everything's bullshit, everything's unknowable? Or how do you approach like gaining information correctly?
Great question.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I do call up a lot of people and have like long, intense conversations. Although, to be honest, that can lead you astray as well. Like people are always like, people around reality often say that this is like a really accurate picture of her. And I think one of the reasons is because reality was not accessible to me. She was in jail. So who could I talk to? I talked to her mother, her yoga teacher, her ex-boyfriends. It's like people around us know us better. Our enemies and our friends can paint like a clear picture. Like you're not going to, you don't know yourself. Like how are you going to explain yourself to a journalist if you even wanted to do that truthfully? Like it makes no sense as an assignment, right? Like
True. I
think our self-knowledge is like profoundly limited. So like I did a profile about Manny Pacquiao and who's a boxer who lives here in Hollywood or did at the time. And he kept being like, when are you going to talk to me? When are you going to interview me? And I was like, all right, I'll interview you. But it's like much more interesting for me to talk to his entourage. And then the whole business story about his entourage, right? So I think like that kind of like direct observation is ideal.
Because to me, it's I don't know if you've ever seen the original British Office, but when David Brent, the reporter, tries to follow him, he said something. He's like, you know, he makes a comment and he goes, Brent mused.
Brent quipped.
Do the piece. And so, you know, I imagine you constantly feel like I mean, I know if I were being interviewed, I would be like, all right, I got to work in like these four things. You know, I'm going to like play Frogger with my material and get to the other side and hope that you kind of print it. But then I imagine from your perspective, when someone comes out with like a quip or an anecdote, if you're just a journalist, like that's good for the article, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it depends. There's a kind of person, there's a kind of guy usually who will just like start talking and won't stop. And you have to like know what to do with that, right? Like you have to know what to pull out. Often it's useless. But a lot of times you want someone to be interacting with someone who's not you, I think. Because that can't be like a genuine interaction.
So is this where what you started wanting to do as a writer? Was this like, was there ever any thought, because I saw you're at the Iowa Writers Workshop, which as far as I know is a like a really serious literary thing that I could never have gotten into when I was interested in that kind of thing. So like how did it all start for you?
Yeah,
like writing and being creative.
Well, I went to Georgetown. That was like a deeply uncreative place in which like everyone was like putting on their ill-fitting suit and going to their internship at their congressperson's office, except for our incredible improv team, which was like John Mulaney, Nick Kroll, Michael Biglia.
Oh, you were on that with them.
I was not on that. Oh, I was there at the same absolutely time. Not. Yeah. I would go to improv and be like, I guess this is improv. Everyone's like a world-class genius.
You stumbled into the best one maybe that ever existed.
It's like improv heroin. You go, I'm chasing the high. I'm going to these improv shows. They suck. What's wrong with me?
Yeah, that's just an aside. There's nothing new to the story. Yeah. But I was a hardcore fan. And then I graduated and I was like, what am I going to do? So I went on journalismjobs.com. And there were two jobs that I applied for. One was in Martha's Vineyard and one was in Burma. And I never heard back from the one in Martha's Vineyard. And the one in Burma, they were like, can you be here in 6 weeks? We'll pay for your shots. And I was like, okay. And that was a military dictatorship at the time. And the job that I was hired for was at a censored newspaper. So, and this is really where those ideas form that like you can't write about fascism without being willing to see the absurdity of all of it. And so we would write these stories and literally we would fax them to the censor, whose name was Wei Lin, and he would fax them back with big black X's like over what you couldn't say. Like that was the process.
Were you ever, because this is something that like I've learned in TV writing, do you ever go like, okay, I'll throw in this thing that should obviously be censored because then maybe they won't censor this other thing, which is like actually the thing I want to be doing. Was there any of the manipulating of the game that way?
I think we were doing that. Yeah. But the thing is, you could never predict it. It would be like, you would be like writing a fluff story about Halloween and they would be like, ghost stories have been illegal since 1962. Like it was so weird. You couldn't even...
That was a great part of your book, by the way, if I can interrupt, where I thought that was such a well-made point where you talk about this fellow named Wei Lin, who's the censor, and he's just this faceless person who, you know, to your mind kind of hates, is the enemy of our stuff. And he's crossing things out. And then you talk about actually meeting him and how he wanted to be your friend. And I think that's such an interesting detail, as you're saying, about the absurdity of all of this. Is here's this person you picture as like this merciless hatchet man. And then you meet him at some social event and he's just like kind of a sad guy who wants to be loved.
Yeah, at a Christmas party.
Yeah. God, that's so cool. I was going to say that like, you know, 9/11 is like our generation's, you know, JFK assassination. It was like the biggest thing, hopefully, that we'll ever have to go through like that. And so I think about it all the time. And something so interesting about the John Walker Lind story was W. Bush's first quote about him, which obviously I didn't remember, but clearly was portrayed as this huge gaffe. Like, how dare W. say this poor fellow? And when I read that, it made me like W. more. Yeah, like, I thought, like, yeah, you know what? He actually totally nailed it. And then he had to spend all this time walking it back and have his parents come on and do damage control on that. It just like, do they, you know, in that moment, there's just, do you feel like there was just no hope of discovering the real story and it was just too ready made for this guy to be a traitor?
Yeah. Yeah. So right. After the whole thing went down with John Walker Lins, Bush kind of accurately identified him as a poor fellow.
Yes.
And people got very upset and his parents had to like walk him back. Yeah. But I think there's this longstanding, like, America needed terrorists. It like needed to process terrorists. It needed to say like, this person is responsible. And yeah. I was just on the phone. I wrote something about a whistleblower named Daniel Hale for New York Magazine. And he just got out of jail and just called me the other day. And he told me that when he was in jail, he was kept in something called the CMU. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, you wrote about it. It's the Communications Management Unit. I was like,
your memory.
Yeah, my memory is not good. And so the Communications Management Unit is something that we built to house terrorists. It's like communications, like you, they're not allowed to talk to anyone. Everything is surveilled, right? And they still exist. So who's in there now? And according to Daniel, it's just like, some guy who said something bad on the internet, you know, like it's like we still have to call these people terrorists because we have to like fill that space. Wow. And I think that's what was happening there. There was like a slot and we needed him to fit in that slot. Well, and poor fellow wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
Do you think it's also like in a way a qualified labor problem to some extent that, you know, like one of the things I always think, and my wife hates when I talk about this, but so, you know, in the LA mayor's race, every time they say we're going to solve this homelessness crisis, this unhoused crisis, and they say we're going to, you know, the wrong approach is policing it. We're going to send social workers out, and it's like I've never met the social worker who's capable of going into a tent city and sort of unraveling the knotted up necklace of problems of the entire thing and converting. I mean, it's such a labor intensive thing. And so when we like going back to John Walker Lind, it seemed like, is it just the intelligence agencies don't have someone who could like intelligently go to Afghanistan and unravel what was happening in the moment? Or is it just the people above them, you think, were demanding like, hey, if anyone is kind of adjacent to this, just trot them out because we have to show results.
Yeah. To your first point, I'm actually just one of my students at Iowa wrote a wonderful book that's forthcoming called The Complications. And it's about his own psychosis. And it makes that point, which is that like there's a lot of platitudes around mental illness that we all like comfort ourselves with, that even if you are very much on the left, like are not, it's like deeply dishonest. As far as like, yeah, I don't think we had the expertise to go unravel everything. But I also think the point of an intelligence agency isn't just to like find intelligence. Like, I think that it's naive to think that that's, in some ways, they're there to serve an agenda, right? Not to like get it right. You know, I'm not sure how much like the torture program, I just don't think existed to like get it right.
Did you grow up in a house of, you know, Kennedy conspiracy theorists and people who were saying like, don't trust the man? And, or was it sort of more conventional, just sort of like, well,
I grew up with like parents who had like no idea, you know, like, I think you can tell from my like extremely spotty and weird employment record that like, I had no help. Right? Like, I really had to figure out things on my own. And so after I was in Burma, I was hired by a libertarian magazine in DC called Reason. And that's where I developed a like very intense skepticism of government. And that was wild. I mean, we had an office in DC, and the people who would walk through that office, it would be like Ralph Nader, Christopher Hitchens, and then like John Stagliano. It was this like pornographer known as Buttman who lives here in LA. Like,
of course.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't know who that was, by the way.
I was looking.
I don't know. I saw a glimmer of recognition on your face.
Stags.
Okay. You know about Buttman?
That's Stags.
So
is he hiring?
Is he hiring?
Oh, that's a cool place to work. I mean, you must
have... It was a really interesting training ground.
So what year is this? Like, put a year on this. So...
This would have been like 2005, 2006.
So this is post 9/11, and it's like magazines are still relevant.
Yeah, it is a real nursing.
Yeah, yeah, that it's like, you know, which is, you know, something else. I don't even know we have time to go into that. But I mean, I used to just relish Thursdays when the magazines would show up and I would just go through my magazines. It was like this big deal. And that's just like largely vanished, you know, for.
Yeah.
Well, you can still get a subscription to New York Magazine. And I would suggest
New York is one of the last ones where I feel like I get, you know, someone will shoot me an article from there like once a month. Like, check this out. Or, you know, it's.
And you're like, I already read this because I have a subscription.
Yeah, of course.
promo code Howley.
20% off.
But so you must have been then at the time, like, you're on the make. And so you're what's going on at Reason? Like, what type of work are you doing there?
It was very much a open borders, like, drugs, you know, like no drug law kind of ethic at the time. It was a lot more left wing than it is now. And that was just a really good training ground, you know, and there was a lot of skepticism at that time of all the just massive amounts of funding that were going toward the things we aren't allowed to know about, right? Like stuff you can't check because it's classified. And from there, that's when I got kind of, I was like, I want to write a good sentence, and like nobody gave a shit. And so then I went to Iowa, and I was in the nonfiction MFA
program. You just casually throw that out. Like, this is a big deal to get. I mean, Iowa is, you know, like, I just always think of like David Foster Wallace hanging out and, you know,
I mean, he
like,
wasn't hanging out.
But, you know, these names that in college as an English student where I was like, I basically had 2 years where I thought I was going to write the great American novel, and instead I wrote a worst-selling book about going bald.
Worst-selling.
When you go to Iowa, I mean, are you going there? Does Iowa, is it just fiction, or there's also reporting? Like, tell us about the program there, because
it's
a prestigious thing.
There's the workshop, which is fiction and poetry. I was in the nonfiction program, and it was incredibly luxurious. I mean, it was just like, I mean, they wouldn't describe it that way. Like, if you talk to a grad student now, they'd be like, I have so much work to do. But it was like, you just could spend all day reading a sentence and trying to figure out how it worked. And
that was
an incredible luxury, and I'm so grateful for it.
And so the goal, I mean, is everyone trying to come out of there going, I have a sample, I'm going to get an agent? Is it careerist, or is it more like, I'm going to, you know, develop a sense of integrity and storytelling? Or is it all of these things? Or
I think it's every kind of self-seriousness you can imagine.
Yeah,
it's the whole gamut of delusion. But it's also, you know, it produces a lot of like truly excellent writing and allows people to develop their style and that kind of thing.
And so you knew that's what you wanted to do, though, at that point. You were saying like, I want to just, you know, was there someone you have as an idol in this space growing up as a type of writer you look toward and modeled yourself after consciously?
I mean, of course, like it's
Joan Didion.
Yeah.
Oh, she's
awesome.
The Didiots.
The authority, the authority in her voice was like very seductive to me, and not something that I was seeing in like a lot of creative nonfiction, which tended to be about, you know, vulnerability or like very much like, who am I to tell this story? You know, like Joan Didion never asked that.
Right.
But I was also interested in like a kind of maximalist style. A lot of people have like read Strunk and White and think there's something like shady about a complicated sentence. So
it's funny,
you know, like I, you know, Moby Dick is a hilarious book. Nabokov is hilarious. Pale Fire is hilarious. And these are people who are really playing with like really complicated sentence structures. So that's something I got into as well.
Oh, that's so cool. I wanted to talk about something we talked about a little bit before we started, which was, I thought an amazing point that you make in the book is that you have, not a great memory, and which is also crazy for being like a writer and a reporter. I think like you would think that a reporter would just have like, yo, I've got it in the
instant
steel trap. But also you made the further point, which I thought was so interesting, that oftentimes people you meet who have fantastic memories are sort of trapped in the emotional trauma of their past. How did you come to that conclusion? Because that was stunning to me. I loved that.
I've taught creative nonfiction to a lot of people, and so I've seen a lot of people with incredible recall. of horrible things that have happened to them, or even just like slightly mundane and unfortunate things that have happened to them. Yeah. And like my memory is, it does create problems for me. Like I do lose track of things, and I'm often having conversations where people are like, this is the third time you've had this conversation.
You know, like, that sounds like me.
But, and I do a trivia game nearby with some friends, and like I've literally never known a single answer. And like if I know one that like everyone knows, my friends will be like, good job. Like it's
you can join Alex's dad's team.
Oh yeah, yeah. We did during the pandemic, we had quite a thing going there. That's very funny. Fun.
His dad was basically you.
He that
was...
yeah.
He'd be like, what was that movie with E.T. in it?
Oh my god. Sorry, Dad. I know you're listening.
Yeah. So but I do think there's something helpful genuinely about coming to a topic fully fresh. Like mm-hmm. I come to a topic with like the enthusiasm and background knowledge of a child, you know,
right.
And then I can, and I have a lens and a critical capacity that then I can kind of apply without, I don't know what the cliches are, so I can't employ them, you know?
Right.
That's a good way to look at it.
Going back to the book, how did you... When you say I want to write about dad or whatever, and you kind of go, okay, 9/11, that's the start of it. And you say this guy, John Walker Lind, who became emblematic of the type of misrepresentation that was going on. Like, how do you then decide, okay, I need to hit reality winner. I've got to like talk about Snowden and Chelsea Manning. Like, how does it build out from there? Is it something that as you're going, you go, people are saying, well, you know, this began with Snowden and with WikiLeaks and Assange, because all these things, honestly, are one blur to someone like me who's, you know, just who digests the news, but it's not my career. So like, as you're structuring something, how do you go about finding what it is you're actually doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part is kind of like comedy. Like, to be clear, it's a blur to me now as well, because I forget what's in it. But when I was inside of it, I knew the material really well, such that I could manipulate it, you know? And like the way, like when someone tells a joke, they're turning something over. They're not like being passive in the face of whatever is happening. Like you, once you have like deeply in your bones, like know a story and have some ideas around that story, you can riff, right? You can say like, oh, this doesn't need to be told consecutively. And in fact, if I told that consecutively, it would be misleading. Like this moment actually relates to this moment, right? And so that's, I think, the kind of associative logic that you're pinpointing.
Because did you know about this guy, John, and I'm going to botch this, Kiriakou?
Oh, yeah.
Are you asking me?
Yeah, like, did you know?
Yeah, it's in the book.
I never heard of this guy. So you go, like, this was a guy who was interrogating John Walker Lind. And then their stories weirdly wind up parallel where they're just both destroyed by this moment. But that wasn't something that, like, even as someone who reads the news, I know. So, like, how did you know that? How do you find that out?
Yeah.
Like, once I was kind of, like, in the world of whistleblowers, he's one of those guys who shows up all the time.
Oh, I
but
see.
I didn't know about that he was going to then, like, whistleblow the fact that his wife was sleeping with someone from, like, Northrop Grumman, right? That he would, like, identify so profoundly with the identity of whistleblower that he would go on to, like, ruin his life. Those were
what
things
a gift
that,
for you.
That emerged from, like, deep study. And after I interviewed him. Like, there are a lot of people who, like, can't not talk, you know. He was someone who like needs to talk.
Do you find that you absorb some of that compulsive insanity, like when you start telling people about what you're doing? Do you have charts on the wall with string and like, because like the second you start talking about reality winner, you sound insane. Not you personally, but I mean as a person, like I'm like, and what they did a reality winner, like people are already like, okay, calm down. You know, and don't get me started on Chelsea Manning and what she did for and like, how do you avoid, you know, because your book is so well reasoned and it made me question everything. But when I tried to convey it to my wife, I instantly sounded nuts. So how do you avoid that? Or
put him to the book.
I don't avoid it. Like, I am that person who I'm like charting everything out, like serial killer stuff. And I also don't understand it when people are like, oh, I don't talk about my work. I can only talk about my work.
Oh,
like,
that's awesome.
There was a point at which I was writing a profile of Larry Nassar, who's this doctor who molested all of these gymnasts. And like, it was all, I'd be like at a party. I'd be like, what about Larry Nassar? Like I had to stop. Like I have no filter, but as those connections are being made, that's like, I'm completely consumed by that. But I do like, yes, you sound crazy when you talk about it because all of it is crazy, you know, like, and the least crazy part is this woman talking about how Monster energy drink is the tool of the devil. Like it's all the same level.
Crazy. Yeah. Hence the name of your book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you think, having analyzed all the data on data, shall we say, like, is there an end game? Like, what is it? I mean, people, you know, it's very scary to think about, and people are always like, oh, the world's going to end and, you know, this kind of stuff. But we go through all these crazy periods in history every generation. There are ridiculous trials and tribulations. It feels like we are stuck in this virtual world right now where we're all willingly part of this surveillance zero America culture. Is there an end to it, or is this just part of us going forward forever?
Right. Is there any way back from it?
Yeah, that would be a shorter way of saying it.
First of all, a question I often get is like, what should I do about my children and the internet? And I never know what to say. And for a while, I was just like stunned in the face of that question. And I realized that people were asking me like to help them surveil their children. You know, that's not what I do. I'm like, I do think there is a way forward. I think it's possible to build an internet that isn't synonymous with surveillance. Like, I think it's possible to build an internet that doesn't have incentives that are only about selling your data, right? And so we could choose that path.
Are you personally paranoid? Like, do you put a piece of tape over your webcam and, like, not enter your information? Or are you just, like all of us... Like yesterday, I was shopping for glasses and they were like, oh, we can virtually try these on. And I scanned my face in and I was like, I shouldn't have done that. 5 minutes later, I was like, now they have my face, my identity, my credit card. I mean, what's your level of paranoia when you engage with this stuff?
I mean, I think I was able to write about this because that is definitely my instinct. It's just like, well, this is a pain in the ass. Yeah. But I do like now having written about reality, like going to jail for saying like, you know, I want to burn the White House down in a text to her sister. Right. Like, I am more careful about what I commit to text. Like, and I feel very comfortable having a phone conversation. Like, I don't think my phone is bugged. Right.
Right.
But I do think that everything I commit to print can be taken from me and shared publicly. So that's about it. But no,
you
I'm not
worry
like
worry about that, given that you work with whistleblowers that someone will say, like, and maybe this has happened. Well, they'll say, like, we could plumb her for information and get her texts and know who that whistleblower was, or, you know, she's someone we should have some leverage against. Does that stuff concern you? Has it come up at all since this?
Yeah. I mean, I have to be really careful when I'm dealing with that kind of private information, and I am. But, you know, this, I've kind of like, you know, my last piece was about Erewhon. It was about a luxury grocery store. So I was
They're coming for you. Right. Yeah. And well, and also, we want to reassure you that this podcast reaches very few people. So you should be okay. You should be okay there.
I have a question about something that you had said earlier. I'm very fascinated by systemic psychology. Mm. And you said something about terrorists. There always needs to be a terrorist in America. And I feel like America's system requires that if somebody leaves this space of terrorism, we need to immediately find someone else to fulfill that, to make the system cohesive. Did you sort of realize something like this in all of your research, or have you always sort of known that this is something that America is part of?
I think that's a great question. And I was just having a conversation with an English professor who made that very point, having read the book. It hadn't occurred to me in quite those terms. But I don't think I've thought of it that systematically. Like, I've just found these individual stories whose people were so ready to say that reality winner, this like 25-year-old CrossFit fanatic from Texas with like unmatched socks, was like a terrifying terror, like stories that make no sense, like with like a moment's reflection, you know? So I think there is that box there, that like terrorist box. And it's just like, we got to sift through information really quickly, right? We don't have time to like take in the details of everything. So we end up putting a lot of it there so we don't have to think about it further.
Right. As someone with a little bit of a foot in academia, do you think that this discourse over like woke is sort of under that umbrella that like, I imagine, I read about this stuff or hear about it and I kind of go, but if you were actually in college, like I'm trying to picture myself caring when I was in college. And, you know, there's certainly in my time, it was like the Antioch Code of Conduct was a big thing. It's like, you know, it's like, well, you need consent for each part of this sexual encounter. Like you should be asking for consent. And we were all just like, okay, no way. But then it gets reported like, you know, on campuses, what's really big is now they're saying everyone needs consent. And it was like this thing. So is this discourse around woke that it's just something they've blown up to have an issue to talk about on the news? And that like, are you encountering that in your daily life?
There was when I was a professor, there was a point where other adults would be like, you're a professor. Are you okay? Are your students attacking you? Are you about to be canceled? It's just like if your entire idea of what Europe is like came from Fox News. So you were like, oh, it's a refugee camp that's always on fire. Right. Like that is the vision that we all now have of what it's like to be on campus. And like, some students were like angry that I taught Schopenhauer and like we had a discussion about it. You know, it was like, I think that there's a lot of hysteria around that. And there are some like horrifying stories as well. But those are not what it's like the modal experience of being a professor, even at Iowa.
Right.
So I want to talk about classified information because this was such a big part of the book and so enlightening that. So one of the things you say is that 2 million people had security clearance in 2003, which was like over 1% of the country. And that, you know, you went to Georgetown. So I imagine there was some foreign service background or some government background that you were educated in that maybe you were interested in that. But then the reality of like Reality Winner's job and Chelsea Manning's job is you go, you're in intelligence and Chelsea Manning is in a skiff, which is like a secret thing that's on a basketball court with a plywood office. What is going on with classified information? So like, why is so much stuff classified?
Yeah, it's just
it is useless. Default. Like how Kiriakou couldn't call his wife about where he was going to lunch because that was classified. Why are these designations so backward? And why is no one, has there not been an audit because no one has the full picture in their head and no one's ultimately responsible?
It's just like where there's not going to be like a political movement to like fix classification. Like that's nobody's top issue. Right.
Right.
But yeah, it's like the default is to classify because you don't want to get in trouble. And also no one will take it seriously if it's not classified. Right. It means means like important.
Oh, that's interesting. So they want to make something seem more important than it is, maybe. Because my inclination would be like, if you go, all of us classified information got out, it's like, well, no one reads. So like, we're all fine. Like there's not a person in the world going to sit down and make their way through it. Yeah. So is part of this then that like the importance of your work can gain importance by you labeling it classified? And also maybe would you say it then provides a cover for less responsibility if you're fucking it up?
I think that's probably true. It's like the situation where more and more people are under the rubric of classification. And so prosecutors have more and more discretion over what they prosecute. So like General Petraeus will be like, oh, here's like 6 notebooks full of state secrets for my girlfriend to read and get a slap on the wrist. But if someone like Reality Winner or Daniel Hale or Kiriakou, somebody with little to no power makes a mistake, they're like, we need to make an example of this, you know? So it's like,
shocked. This started with Obama. This is what I learned from the book. So why do you think that was the case? I mean, in your book, you say it was only because they felt they could win the case. So do you think it's just career building?
Obama ran under this idea that he was going to be the most transparent president of all time. And then he went on to enforce the Espionage Act more than any other president before him, like combined. And he did that, I think, because it was possible, because now suddenly everything was online and there were records of everything. Like, so, you know, 30 years ago, if some government contractor gets mad and shares something, that would have been hard to trace. With Reality, you know, they were like, okay, this document's out. 6 people have logged onto this document. this person also seems to have been on the reading The Intercept on her work computer. You know, like you just had everything you needed to convict right there. So I think a lot of it was just like opportunity. And I also think he didn't know what he was getting into. Like suddenly he's in charge of this vast network of classified data, which as we said, is like encompasses a percent of the American population.
That's great.
And that's like scary, right? That's not secure.
So when you hear that there's classified documents at Mar-a-Lago or in Joe Biden's, you know, garage or wherever that was, is that a cause for concern or is
no.
What do you make of that? Or do you think like, because, you know, someone like me, anytime there's dirt on Donald Trump, I'm like, oh, good. But then sometimes as you dig into the cases, you go, it's like when I'm trying to show someone a video that I thought was funny and I want it to be funny and I can see they don't think it's funny. And so I'm pressing and I'm going, but look, see, he fell off the surfboard, where it's like, is this Mar-a-Lago thing, which, you know, like I desperately want to go like they got him dead to rights. Is it a lot of ado about maybe nothing?
I mean, it can be fun to watch Donald Trump get in trouble, even if it's much ado about nothing, right? Like, yeah. Those aren't exclusive. Like, I was really surprised to see that the press reporting, even reporters who know about the classification system, being like, holy shit, classified data in the garage. Like, no, everything is classified. Like, it's right. Not a surprise, you know? Like,
so, do you think that is the argument that he's self-selected some of this stuff? And it's like, you know, here's a document about, I don't know, like a nuclear fission that's possible and only three people know about this versus like, you know, these are the texts. These are Alex Sulkin's texts.
Hey, wait a minute.
what could this information be realistically?
Well, I think that's really interesting. And I have an interview with a famous whistleblower about this very subject in New York Magazine. I think Trump, he's like a collector. So he was like, this is top secret. Like only I can have this.
Right.
He probably, you know, like he sees that, yeah. Value just in the level of classification is like, oh, only I get to have this and I want to keep it. Right.
Yeah.
Like what's shocking about what Trump did is he like refused to give this stuff back and then like hid it in his bathroom. Like everything that came off just like having a box of classified information, the actual having of classified information is like, okay, you know, like most of what's classified is just like we were talking about mundane information that didn't need to be classified anyway. I don't think that's the case with what he has. I think he has like actual state secrets, but
do you knowing what you know about, you know, how people's whose lives have been turned upside down by this system. So reading this, I go, so when Donald Trump gets up and he's talking about the deep state or whatever, like I get the appeal of it, even though I don't like the messenger.
Right.
Is there a chance that he actually has the right idea here and like we're just so blinded by the fact, like, you know, liberals like me are so blind by the fact that we don't like him that it's like, no, what he's doing is actually great? Or is it just what it appears to be, which is a grift, and that he uses buzzwords that sort of push hot button issues and people get motivated, but he doesn't know any more about classified information and like the deeply corrupt nature of it than I do?
I mean, I think the thing to know about QAnon is to think about everything we've been through with this secret state that was revealed to us largely by Snowden and other whistleblowers, that is legitimately a secret state that was legitimately hiding from us what was happening, which was mass surveillance. Q, like, who is Q? Q is a whistleblower, right? So this is a insane, like,
Q in the fictional sense, or isn't the guy Q that guy in the Philippines who's making it up?
Yeah. Right. But like the idea of it, like it's this baby eating fantasy.
Yes.
You know, about like leading adenochrome or whatever, built on this like reality that like there is a secret state that we haven't had access to, that like whistleblowers have revealed to us. And so it makes sense that these people are like, a whistleblower is going to like reveal the truth to us and everything is going to be better. I mean, QAnon is like a positive movement. It's like a movement that feels like things can get better, right? Like Donald Trump is going to arrest all the pedophiles and then everything will be great. You know, these are optimists.
Right. Oh, wow.
What rose-colored glasses you just saw them with. That was incredible. Oh. Well, you know, I'm thinking just as from the writer's side, because we have writers who listen and people who want to write who listen. and Goldie's done it. I've never done it. You've now done it twice, which is sit down to write a book. And so when you sat down to write your second book, which is the one we've been discussing today, did you have the same feeling of holy shit at the beginning? Or did you say to yourself, like, okay, I've done this before, I can do it again?
That's such an interesting question, because I feel like I will have that for the next book. But now I'm like, is that just total delusion? Because I didn't have that for the second book.
Right.
Because it was a very different kind of book. My first book was about two MMA fighters. And no, I really didn't know. I think you have to make peace with that feeling of being lost for the entire process.
Wow.
To make something interesting. And like, that's
that a great thing for our listeners to hear, by the way.
Yeah.
Cause that's an amazing statement, to make peace with the fact that you're just like, literally your confidence is shaky.
Yeah. Like that you have to, you're constantly going to be asking yourself, like, is this a book? Like, is this worth doing? Like that, like being able to tolerate the constant buzzing of those feelings is what it is to be able to write a book.
Wow. That's so well.
Do you have a specific process? Like, I mean, granted, my book was very stupid, but
so funny.
You know, my
Goldie.
Process was like, I just said, okay, I'll look at the word count. And, you know, when I've done over 750 words, I can stop for the day, but I can't stop before then. Do you employ anything similar, or because your work is more nuanced, you can't really do that?
I did that for some of it, and then I would put it away for like months. It's been 10 years since my first book. I wrote some of it on a writing retreat, and I would highly recommend getting away from one's children for as long as possible.
Yeah, it's not happening. My book was written with like a pillow over my head, and I'm not even kidding. I would just put a pillow over my head and then hide in my bed with my iPad. And oh my go God. In
that
the works too.
That's a good. That's your strategy.
Yeah, it's your escape.
Well, knowing everything you know, having written this book about data and how we're using it to kill the wrong people all over the world. And then our texts are being used. Our joke texts are being used to prosecute us. And
right.
Is there a reason to be optimistic about anything? how do you keep going, knowing all this?
I think no one could have predicted where we are. Like, you know, whatever idea you have about how your declinist vision of how everything's going to fall apart can't possibly be right, because we don't have enough information to like predict. Like, no one was like, Trump's going to take over and like create like deportation camps. Like, that was not something anyone could have predicted. So
the people at SNL knew that when they asked him to host. I think we've established that.
Yeah. Although that was my favorite episode.
I just think there's so much uncertainty, but I also think that like there is a growing awareness of how vulnerable we are when we put information out there. And I think like younger generations aren't really doing it in the same like lazy, stupid way like millennials are, right? Like, I think their shit is like disappearing, you know, that they're and then there's a new kind of cool and status to privacy that there wasn't before. So I think that the culture will adapt, and that there will be more resources for people who are interested in like keeping a zone of privacy around themselves. But it might be too late for us. I don't know.
That's an interesting point. So do you think privacy will become a commodity, like a nice house or a pool or something? Like, the people that have more of a sort of internet privacy it'll be like almost like a status thing?
I mean, that's darker than what I was saying. I mean, that's
a black mirror right there.
Well, the last thing that, you know, you've been so generous with your time that I want to talk to you about is you've had a foray into Hollywood, I assume. You're making a reality winner movie.
Oh,
is that made or is that
it's made. It just premiered at Sundance.
Well, oh my congratulations.
God. Congratulations. Congratulations.
How was that process of going? And you wrote the screenplay, correct?
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Winner.
Nice.
Was this your first screenplay?
It was, yeah. It's a comedy. It's starring Zach Galifianakis as her father and Patty Britton as her mother.
Oh, wow.
And Emily Jones as reality. And that was, you know, people are like, oh, it's so different. But writing a feature, like a magazine feature, is also about setup and payoff. So it was like not as distinct an experience as you would think. But it was really fun. And for the first time at Sundance, I got to experience the something that will be very familiar to you guys, which is like...
Nope. Not Sundance. Totally unfamiliar. But congratulations to you. No.
The experience of people laughing at jokes you've written, like in your midst. Oh, barely, I was like, wow, barely. This is nice. Yeah. You know?
No, I've... I mean, we could go on and on.
I know, that's about too fraught. That. That's too fraught.
No. All right. It was new to me. Yeah. And also, yeah. like Zach just making my joke 10,000 times funnier with just, like, there's one thing I wrote and he just, like, added a thumbs up. And it was like, wow, that you took that joke from so mediocre to, like, just perfect physical comedy, you know? So that was really new and really exciting.
So is this what you're going to be doing going forward? Are you trying to do other movies or people coming up to you saying, hey, this winter is great? Can you?
Oh, yeah. As soon as I leave the house, there's just a line of people asking to write like strange, like indie movies about whistleblowers.
No, but I mean, has it led to, do you see yourself maybe, you know, trying to just keep doing movies or you just want to keep, I hope you're going to keep doing the work of the book that, you know, and that type of thing, because we need people like you and not people like us. But I get why you might want to jump ship for the cushiness. What are your plans going forward?
I mean, I love writing for New York. I love, as someone who is like easily bored, that like every 5 months or something, I get to learn about a completely different world. So I'm going to keep doing
that.
Do you
pick those out, or does an editor, like, I just picture, you know, a Ben Bradley type editor, you know, coming in and going, I got a hot scoop.
Yeah.
That's
does that happen, or does it, or do you get the hot scoops?
I mean, I would love for a Ben Bradley type guy to give me a hot scoop. Like, I'm not an ideas person. So a lot of times, like, the reality winner did come from an editor. It's like half and half. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. But I would love to write more films. And I'll write another book. But my regular gig is at New York.
Awesome.
Goldie, you got us such a good guest.
I know. Great
job. Yeah, your turn. Your turn.
I know. Yeah. Who do I get?
Yeah. Go out in the world and find someone cool. Carrie Howley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone
so much.
Has to read this book, Bottoms Up and the Devil Laughs.
That was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. God, it's great having actual authors on the show. Carrie was just so cool to talk to.
Yes.
That book is
thank
so
you,
awesome,
Goldie.
Thank you for making the effort to get her as a guest. It was great talking to her. And you did
so
a great
are
interview.
You saying I kind of am a producer?
Yes.
Let's not, JC, can I talk to you out in the hallway for a second?
Wait, I got to get CJ to...
Oh, CJ, that's right. One of our fans thinks JC is CJ, and we think that's very hilarious.
It's
and
also,
by the way,
yeah.
it's a lateral
yeah.
difference.
It's a pretty cool name.
I think instead of Jesus Christ, you are Christ Jesus. Christ, comma, Jesus. And Christ, comma, Jesus, it's time for Top 5.
Top 5.
There we are. We sound awesome. Okay, this was mine this week.
Yes.
And the category is Top 5 songs that are better than the movie they're in. Here we go.
Right.
I think you'll sense there's a pocket that I live in here, an era. Okay, 5, and this is, you know, controversial. It's kind of a corny song. I happen to love it. Number 5 for me is Say You, Say Me. From the movie White Nights, which stunk.
Totally.
But that movie was, I mean, but that song is kind of good.
Yeah.
Number 4.
That is such a great song that I've totally forgotten about.
Yes. Is that true?
Lionel.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm
so
glad you guys
good.
Love it. That makes
it's
me feel
so
good. Number 4, and this was, I mean, this was one of the reasons I did the list. Number 4, Against All Odds.
Dude, crossover?
Yes. From the terrible movie Against All Odds came the Oscar-winning song Against All Odds, which also we've mentioned Against All Odds on here before because it was the top 5 Leave It All on the Floor songs. Like that was absolutely, I would have paid to be in that recording session to watch him go to town, to watch that small bald man just kill it.
All right.
I knew that was going to get a response. That's
that
just
so
what
good.
You said about him last week.
Yeah.
All right,
but
I get
he's
it. You're allowed
to
say it. I'm not. Number 3, and this could have been number 1. I'm kind of mad now that it isn't. Number three for me is Arthur's theme, parentheses, Moon in New York City.
That's nice.
From the movie Arthur. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people love the movie Arthur. I don't. Like, I feel like it missed me. I find it annoying and almost impossible to get through. But I love that song. I want to be buried to that song.
You're not really sympathetic to Arthur.
No.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point.
The rich drunk.
Is my apartment too nice?
Yeah, I know. It's like, yeah, these are not the problems that we all deal with. Number two, a little ballad from the 90s called Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith from the movie Armageddon, which stunk, but the song is a good one.
Number one
the whole time. There's a song called Kiss from a Rose by Seal in the unwatchable Batman and Robin. It was either Batman and Robin or Batman Forever. Back when Batman's got really terrible. But that song is amazing. That's my list. JC,
list.
What do you got?
I was looking up which Batman. It's just Batman. Batman Forever.
Thank you.
Okay. So I like this category.
Oh, good.
My number five is a song called A Real Hero from the movie Drive.
Oh.
Which.
What's Drive?
Is that Ryan Gosling, like he's like a driver from.
I mixed that up with Baby Driver. Those are two different movies.
The soundtrack is super 80s and it's very stylized.
But I kind of remember enjoying Drive. Did you think it was just a forgettable movie with a great song or.
No, I liked the movie, but I didn't love it. And I think I love this song. Okay. I listen to it a lot. Yes. My number four, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now by Starship in the movie Mannequin. Yes.
I love it.
Number three, Against All Odds from Against All Odds. There's our crossover.
There we go.
Number two, a song called Crazy for You from the movie Vision Quest.
Yes.
Horrible movie. Amazing song.
Disagree that it's a horrible movie. Love that movie.
Is it a Madonna song?
Yes.
But I agree that the song, even in my mind, is better than the movie. But I love that movie. Loudon Swain. What's his face? That was his character name.
Matthew Modine.
Matthew Modine, yeah.
I got to see it again. Now I got to be like, okay. And my number one is a song called Lose Yourself from the movie 8 Mile.
Yes.
8 Mile's good, though.
Yeah.
But song is better.
I guess. I mean, I think it's a great movie, great song.
Yes.
Yeah, your buddy's in it, so of course you love it.
Cheddar Bob, my oldest friend.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have him on someday. He's an actor. He could talk to us about
Leave something. The producing to the producers, Goldie.
Oh, my God.
So I've never done this. I'm going to just do seven. I didn't. I felt like it was difficult to.
Wait, hold on, JC.
Top seven. I just. I reserve the right to once every few years not pare it down.
Do it. Reserve it. Go.
Okay, number seven. I Will Always Love You.
From the Body Guy.
I did have that, and
that's a good one.
It's a great song.
It really is.
Number six, the Lego 2 end credits song.
Who's that?
Which was hilarious.
Is that Everything Is Awesome?
No, it's a song about the credits and why you should stay for the credits by Beck, and it's great.
Oh my God, that's cool. Great.
Number five. From the movie A Star Is Born, Shallow, the Bradley Cooper song, where I actually do like his music.
Wow.
I forgot to tell you, a friend said, I have a connection with Bradley Cooper, and I might be able to get him on your podcast. And I was like, here's the thing.
Don't have him listen to anything
that
in the last 3 months.
That is probably the one person we cannot have on the podcast.
Because we would look like hypocrites by kissing his ass. Yeah.
Well, also, I mean, he would probably get wind before. Like,
you think he would smell it coming?
Yeah, he's at the subway tunnel.
Listen, you can smoke on the podcast. I'll do it. So number four is 9 to 5.
Oh, yes, that was.
I considered that.
Yes,
I considered that.
Great choice.
Number three, Lady Marmalade. From Mulan Gray.
I've never heard of that one.
Number two, Gangster's Paradise.
Yes.
And number one, great song, and I do not think this is a very good movie, Footloose.
Wow.
Oh, no. Wow. No. That song and movie are neck and neck.
Wait.
The next town over allows dancing. Yes. Once you learn that, who cares?
But didn't
just
that movie,
dance there.
That
it's
movie
fine.
Also has Let's Hear It for the Boy, right?
Yes.
Which I
and it also
love.
Has Holding Out for a Hero. I need a hero.
That's from I didn't know that was from
yeah.
Well, the whole soundtrack is
and it also has Almost Paradise. Paradise. Great soundtrack. I think it's an equally good movie. And by the way, that came out 40 years ago, like last week. It made me feel very old.
Wow, that's crazy.
Along with my tubular villus adenoma also making me feel old. Anyway, great. Goldie, I'm glad you got way into
that.
I loved hearing the seven. So what do we have next week for top five?
I don't think we've done this. If we have, I have a backup.
Okay.
Your top five best live shows you've ever seen.
Ooh.
No.
Okay.
That's good. That's great. Really good. Oh, I'm putting myself there right now.
Almost Paradise. Is that where you're?
That's a Footloose live. Okay. That'll be fun next week. And also
thanks.
Next
That's
week, we have a guest who we know very well, and we are incredibly excited to talk to Chris Sheridan. So yeah. Chris Sheridan wrote on Family Guy for years, was a showrunner for years, and now has created and is running Resident Alien, which has been on now for 3 or 4 seasons on the Sci-Fi Network. It just moved over to Netflix as well. Yeah. So if you want to check it out, it's a really fun show. Really fun show. So we're excited to talk to him next week. But now, back by popular demand, let's close the show as we used to and now apparently have to again, the high note. Tom and Max are
I've
back. I like that.
That
part about it. And we got nibbles on Tom Gamble. He's going to be coming back in the coming weeks. We're excited to talk to him about the Oscars and this project that he has going on that sounds hilarious.
Yes. Can't wait.
Quickly, my high note, my daughter Levy was in her class play recently. And boy, it was just a joy to watch her. She really absolutely came to life performing. The show was called It's a Jungle Out There. And so all the classmates were dressed as different, you know, animals. And she was one of the elephants. It was just awesome watching her singing and dancing. And by the way, there were groups. So there were like 4 elephants, 4 monkeys, 4 hyenas, 4, you know.
Yes.
The monkeys were so fucking great and tight. They were like, it was like they had been working together for 10 years in vaudeville.
Whoa.
They were nailing it. Meanwhile, boy, the poor elephants. Levy was on it, but she was literally like, had to be like a conductor for other people's lines. Like she's turning to everybody, like pointing at them, your turn.
Well, let me ask you, because you and I both recently saw The Wiz, same production.
Yep.
Do you think all theater should just be children? Like, even if you see something like The Wiz and it's good, don't you think it's better to just watch a bunch of kids do it? Like it's a child's pursuit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm on the fence about that. I still am chasing that Les Mis dragon. Because when I first saw Les Mis, and that's very adult and populated by adults, I was absolutely blown away. But I agree, in the last decade, even 2 decades, the most enjoyable theater I've seen has involved small children.
That with Wayne Brady?
Yes.
The Wiz?
Brady came out in the audience when Ape Shit. And I told Goldie this, there was a very old man at intermission walking with a cane up the aisle towards us who just threw up on the ground and continued walking. So this is the LA theater experience that you folks are missing.
Did anyone clean it or anything?
Yes, some poor usher who was like older too came out with the gloves and was on his knees with the scrub, like just how you'd picture it. So that was a fun intermission. All right, other high notes.
Do you want to go? Should I go?
Sure, I'll go.
Okay.
So I've been married to my wife since 2009. And I guess my high note is the two of us, I think we're finally figuring out how to be married.
Ooh, oh, congratulations. Awesome.
Which is great.
That's 15 years.
Like,
right?
We're definitely getting better at it.
That's good. Yes.
So, yeah.
Congratulations. Hey,
that's a good high note.
Yeah.
It is. That's a huge high note.
Yeah. Awesome.
Congratulations.
Well, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got our 15 year coming up too. We're married the same year as you guys were.
Crazy.
I know, right? My high note is the original Dora, voice of Dora. I don't know if people know this, but they're bringing back Dora as a reboot. She is playing the mother of Dora in this reboot. And I've known Kathleen since she was like six. And wow. So, and worked with her until she was, got too old. And she was still doing toys when she was 17, but we stayed in touch. So it's just, I love this whole keeping it in the family. And she's so proud. And I really do miss and love my Dora family. They're amazing people. So that is awesome. My high note.
Yes. Let me say a phrase and you tell me if this is something. Okay. Pre-boot.
Pre-boot.
It's a pre-boot.
Oh, it's a pre-boot.
Yeah. Ooh. I like it. Pre-boot. Yeah. Pre-boot.
A pre-boot. We rewrite the past.
Yeah. Oh. I had a thought the other night as I was drifting off to sleep, and it was just the phrase gay Archie Bunker. Is that something?
You fell asleep to that.
Yeah, that's something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Conservative gay man is very rich.
Okay. Yes.
All right. We'll talk more about that, Goldie.
Yeah.
Behind closed doors from JC.
I know. I want to be a producer on it.
Too. All right. Well, that was a fun show. Again, Carrie Howley, awesome.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Real author. Great, interesting, awesome book, which is called, Goldie, give us that book title again. The Devil Laughs. Oh, no.
Bottoms Up and the Devil Laughs.
Bottoms Up and the Devil Laughs. It was, God, it was so interesting.
So good.
Yep.
So smart.
Thank you.
So...
Thanks again for getting her. Yes. Thank you, too, for being awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening in Yemen and Israel. And we will talk to you again next week.
No way.
That was fun.
That was fun. That was fun.
And it stops right now.
Does he still work on the show?
He does.
I'm just a deucer.